Good morning and welcome for Computer Graphics. In this week, we are looking into rasterization. On Monday, we spoke about the rasterization of lines. And I've shown you an algorithm, the Bresenham algorithm, which is optimized for efficiency, that is able to rasterize lines using integer arithmetics only, which is very advantageous if the algorithm is to be implemented in hardware, for instance, or on cheap hardware, where floating point is more expensive and also requires more energy, maybe, than integer. But nevertheless, lines are probably not the most important primitive that we use in today's computer graphics, because we don't want to draw these wireframe models where the silhouettes of the objects are rasterized using lines, but we really want to draw filled objects. And this is what we look into today, polygon rasterization. Yeah? So whereas last week we were looking in how to rasterize such a line here, not last week, on Monday, today we fill primitives. And the typical primitive we will look at are triangles, because everything can be composed from triangles. So this is the most important part, in fact. Yeah. So if we want to describe our scenes, I already spoke about that. We typically have this path, these path objects, for instance. All these objects can be decomposed into polygons. Yeah, so even the curves contain line segments. They are just so small and so finely subdivided that we don't see that it's only a polygon. But in the end, so all these primitives become polygons, and such a polygon is simply described by a set of points, P1, P2, P3, P4, P5 in this case. Often, we will also learn why these are ordered in a particular order, clockwise or counterclockwise. And every shape can be approximated by such a polygon, and each such polygon can be subdivided into triangles. This is a process that we call triangulation. Now it depends. Some algorithms can handle polygons directly. Others can only handle triangles. And in that case, then every polygon first has to be subdivided into such triangles before they can be rasterized. Yeah? And this subdividing into triangles is a process, triangulation. It's very simple if we have convex polygons like this here, but if we have non-convex polygons, that alone is an interesting question. We don't look into that for now. But the important thing is, we use triangles as primitives and sometimes also polygons. And the algorithm that we speak about mostly today, the scanline rasterization algorithm, works on arbitrary polygons. But in practice, GPUs that do most of these rasterization tasks only look at triangles, for good reasons. We will also see that in the end. Okay, so that's one issue. The primitives that we want to rasterize. And then there's another issue that I also want to speak about right now, and we will maybe come back to this issue, but keep that in mind. If we do rasterization, we have to define what we mean with rasterization. And that's not 100% clear. I already discussed that for lines on Monday. Yeah. So what is a line between two points, or how is such a line rasterized? You saw that there are different options to define that. And also for polygons, this is not really clear. And what we use in the very beginning now is the following very simple rasterization rule, and this is to rasterize, or during rasterization, for every pixel we determine the color of that pixel at its center. So we take the center point of the pixel, and then we determine the color at this center point. So that means if we have two triangles or two objects, yeah, and within that pixel, yeah, the pixel, yeah, is sort of, yeah, covered by this red and this blue triangle, yeah. And in that case, if we take that very simple rasterization rule that we simply look at the center and take the center color for the entire pixel, yeah, we color that pixel red. But obviously, yeah, that's not the best solution because within that pixel, we have two triangles. Yeah, we have a red and a blue part. And this results in aliasing in these staircase artifacts. Yeah, this rasterization rule that we already saw for the line rendering. And even if pixels are very small today, this generates problems. Yeah, this aliasing problem, I already spoke about it last Monday, is, yeah, a severe problem and an interesting problem. So a typical solution is that we don't use a single sample per pixel, but multiple samples per pixel. And that essentially, yeah, we rasterize, or during rasterization, we determine color values for each of these subpixels or for each of these samples within a pixel. So in that case, we would get within that pixel two red and two blue color values. Yeah? And then in the end, we mix these colors or we interpolate these colors. So we get, yeah, something magenta, purple-like in that case. Yeah? And now, of course, sampling here is essentially an approximation what, in the end, maybe is the best choice would be that we really compute the coverage within the pixel. So that means we really, I mean, when we rasterize a triangle, we know its vertices, yeah? Let's even assume that we have then in floating point precision, yeah? So they don't have to snap to pixels, but we really have them as floating point. So we can somehow geometrically compute how, which fraction of that pixel is covered by that triangle and can make a perfect coverage computation. And this would, and this here is essentially just an approximation. Yeah, the more samples here we use, the more precise our result gets, but of course also the more work we have to spend and the more memory, because we have to store all these colors per pixel. Yeah, now we have multiple colors per pixel. And computing coverage, as I described it before, would be possible, but that becomes very, very complicated. Here, that's a very simple case. Here, we only have two triangles per pixel. But imagine cases where we render, for instance, a forest. Every forest has many trees. Every tree has many branches. Every branch has many leaves. And every leaf is composited of many triangles. And then within a pixel, yeah, you have 20 leaves. And they occlude each other. And now you really want to compute the coverage of every single leaf to determine the right color. That's not doable. Maybe if it's doable, then definitely not in real time as you would like it for a computer game. Yeah, so this is the practical approach. In fact, this is very often used. And if you, some of you maybe know that dialogue, if you have a GPU on your computer and you use the dialogue to set the quality, you always have these anti-aliasing options, yeah, and there you can choose number of samples, for instance, and this is exactly this number here. And it's a trade-off between quality and performance, and you see if you choose the highest possible quality, then probably your frame rate goes down, but your image maybe looks nicer. Okay, so nevertheless, for now we will look at this very simple rule, or let's assume we take this very simple rule. Normally these algorithms can be rather easily extended to also do this here. Or another option would also be that we simply render at a higher resolution, yeah, and then simply scale down the image by averaging several pixels to a single one. There are several options to do that. For now, we simply use that, and just keep in mind that aliasing and anti-aliasing is an interesting problem. Okay, good. So with this in mind, yeah, we can define a simple rasterization rule for polygons now. And the idea is that given is a polygon, mostly a triangle, we know the coordinates of the vertices. We also don't use integer coordinates now, but real float values. So the vertices can lie anywhere, yeah, within a pixel. And our rasterization rule simply says, find all the pixels that are within the polygon, and within the polygon means that their center is within the polygon. Yeah? So that's a very simple rasterization rule, and this is what we want to find now. That means, yeah, we do not only want to draw the boundary of the triangle, as we did on Monday, but we also want to fill. And maybe the first idea that some of you have is, that's not very difficult, yeah, because we know how to rasterize the boundary. Yeah, we take Brasenheim, that's very efficient. And then we simply use that an algorithm to fill that one. Yeah, like in every paint program, you have this, typically have this icon with a bucket. Okay, maybe I shouldn't. Usually it looks like this, yeah? And it's the idea is that you click in the center of such a triangle, and then it fills the triangle with color. Yeah, so there's a simple algorithm to do that. It's called the seed fill algorithm. And in fact, it is not the algorithm that is used in practice for that purpose. But yeah, I think it's a nice algorithm, so we can briefly speak about it, because maybe in other places you might need it. And the idea of that algorithm, so the algorithm in the end is very, very simple, but it's recursive. Yeah? And while you learn in first semester lectures maybe that recursion is good, I tell you recursion is not good because it's slow, it requires memory, and so forth. Yeah. So, okay, you can discuss that if you wish. At least for our purpose, yeah, recursion is something you want to avoid. Because performance is very important for us. So, the idea is, or idea is very simple of this algorithm. So let's assume we want to fill a region, yeah, and the boundary of that region is already drawn in some particular color, some boundary color. And now we want to fill starting from a seed point in our shape. Yeah, we start filling neighboring pixels until we hit a boundary. Yeah, and it's like, yeah, filling like this icon here. Yeah, filling color, and the color spreads on our canvas until it hits a boundary, and the boundary stops. And this can be described recursively in a very simple way. Yeah, so we start at the seed point, we set it to the fill color, and then we look at all the neighbor points and do the filling recursively for these neighbor points. Only if these neighbor points are not on the boundary. And this is an algorithm, a recursive algorithm, and this is how it looks like. I mean, it's very, very simple. Yeah, the idea is seed fill, so that's the position where we want to start the filling. Fill color is the color in which we want to fill our object. And now the idea is, if the pixel for which we call this method is already filled, we return, yeah, because then we are done. And if it is not the case, we set it to the fill color and call the method recursively for the neighbors. Yeah? And now the neighbors, I mean, this, in fact, I just realized that it doesn't use the boundary color, but it only looks whether the fill color is already set. Yeah, but it boils down to exactly the same. Yeah? We could also check whether this is not equal to the boundary color, and then we have the algorithm I described before. Okay, so how does that look in practice? Let's take this very simple example. Yeah, so we have a rectangle. This is the boundary. Yeah, and we start at the center. So we call the seedfill algorithm for this pixel. And in it is in the beginning, and it's not the fill color, so we set it. Yeah, and then we start our recursion. And in our recursion, we first go to the right, left, up, and down. So we go to the right, that's this pixel, it's not set, so we set it and we recurse. Yeah, so we end up here, not set, we set it and recurse. Go to the right again. We set it, go to the right, and now we've reached the boundary. Yeah, so it's now the first time that our recursion stops. Yeah, so we go back, and next we go left, I think it was right, left, up, down. So we go left, on left it's already set, yeah? So we go up, and here it's not set, yeah? So from there on we continue. We set that one, go to the right, is set. We go to the left, not set. We fill it, we go to the right, is already set. Go to the left and fill it, and so forth, yeah? Can try and reconstruct it. Here we see the recursion tree, yeah? And because our recursion is pretty wide, yeah? So we recurse in four branches, yeah? Or we can. These are the recursions that stop because we hit the boundary. And what you can also see, yeah, is that the recursion is very, very deep. In fact, probably it's 18 pixels that are set, and they are probably all set in a recursion. So we have a recursion depth of 18. And so that means if we have a large image with maybe 1 million pixels and we want to set 100,000 pixels, or we have a large triangle with 100,000 pixels, that would mean we have a recursion depth of 100,000. Yeah, which is horrible. Performance-wise and also memory-wise, we need a very large stack, yeah, to store all these parameters of the recursion. That's not really practical. But it's a nice algorithm, yeah, and it's very short, and it's very difficult to program it incorrectly.
For our purpose. This is a problem. We also, there's another very practical problem, and this is how do we really handle these boundaries, yeah? Because we do not only render a single triangle, but we want to render many triangles. So we have to assume that already hundreds of triangles have been rasterized, yeah? And we are rasterizing now new triangles on top of these maybe. Yeah, so the fill color, so maybe we want to rasterize a triangle in a color that has already been rasterized before. Yeah, so we really need to define our boundary uniquely. We need to define a unique color for that particular triangle so that we don't mix with previous triangles and have to first draw the boundary in this particular unique color. Another problem is that we need to pick a point inside for a triangle that's very simple, but if we have more complex shapes like this, for instance, yeah, if we take the barycenter, that would be this point, yeah, but this is not within our shape. So first of all, yeah, it's not trivial to find a point that is really inside this contour. That's another problem. Then we need to fill with this, so we need to draw our boundary with a unique color, then we need to fill with this unique color, and then in the end, replace all these set pixels, yeah, by the color which we really want, yeah, and so forth. And another problem in this algorithm, so we will see later, in fact, normally we don't want to fill our triangle with a unique color, but we want to do something which we call shading. That means we want to be able to define different colors, for instance, for the vertices, and then to interpolate these colors over the triangle, yeah, so that we have a shading, a gradient, of colors, yeah, because real world objects, yeah, do not have a uniform color, yeah, but they have a gradient, a color gradient. And to be able to do that, we need something which we call shading, and this is difficult to integrate also here. Okay, yeah, so it's a nice academic algorithm, I would say, yeah, but not practical. And what we need, in fact, is an approach that sort of directly enumerates the pixel within such a polygon or a triangle. So, yeah, we really need something that, given a triangle, it tells us, okay, set this pixel, this, that really enumerates the pixel one after the other that are within this triangle. And for this, we could think about a very simple algorithm, and simple is good, usually, and in fact, this is also an algorithm that is often used, and it's rather likely that on your mobile phone you have an architecture for rasterization that uses, yeah, not directly this algorithm, but an optimization that I will show in a minute. One simple option would be the following, that we say, okay, we take our triangle, or, yeah, for now let's assume we only have triangles, and we describe or we transform the edges of these triangles, to half spaces. So that means, yeah, for each of these edges, we define a half space. Such a half space is normally defined, as you can see here, by a point and a normal. And the half space, yeah, consists of all the points that are on the sort of positive side of this edge that is defined by this point and this normal. Yeah, so the half space in this case, yeah, is all this here. And now we can define such a half space for all these edges, and every point that is within all these half spaces are exactly points within that triangle. Yeah? So the triangle is the intersection of three such half spaces. And describing such a half space is very simple, because we can do that essentially with a scalar product. So if we say we have some point x or p and a vector n, yeah? N is this normal here. Normal means it's a vector that is perpendicular on this edge here. Yeah, so this point and this normal defines this edge, and if we have now an arbitrary point x, yeah, we simply take that normal equation that I hope you've already seen in other lectures or maybe in school before. We simply take this vector, this is x minus p, and look at the scalar product with n. And the scalar product, yeah, determines the projection of this point onto n. And if this projection is positive, then we are on this side of the edge. And if we have a point here, for instance, yeah, this projection will be negative, and we are on the other side. So here the same is smaller than zero, and here this is zero. This is exactly this implicit form that we used for Brasenham on Monday. Yeah, this implicit form. But here the line is an edge, yeah, of our triangle. Okay, so this makes it very simple, yeah, to determine for an arbitrary point on which side of the edge we are. And if we transform our triangle to three such equations here, yeah, for a particular point, we can very quickly find out, yeah, we just need to compute these scalar products for each of these edges, and if they are all positive, then we are inside the triangle. Yeah?
Sorry, but what about the points that is below the particular edge?
Like,
it would still project on the normal.
Yeah?
Or outside the triangle, it would still project on the normal and the positive side.
Yes. for this half space here, but not for this one. Yeah? So it is within this half space, yeah? So it's within the half space of this edge, but with respect to this edge, it's outside. Yeah? And it really needs to be inside all three edges. Yeah? And then we are inside the triangle. And that's a very simple test. We just have to transform. Yeah, we have to compute these normals and so forth. I won't show how to do that here, but it's rather simple. It's a kind of pre-computation per triangle. So independent on the number of pixels, which is good. Yeah, and then we can quickly determine for every pixel whether it's inside the triangle or not. And so a very brute force algorithm would be that we just go over all pixels of our image, and for every pixel we determine whether we are in the triangle or not. And if we are inside the triangle, yeah, we simply rasterize it. Of course, that's very, very, I mean, in that image, it looks like a reasonable idea. But if you imagine in reality, we have 2 million pixels, yeah, and now we have a tiny triangle and iterate over all pixels, yeah, and just to hit the 3 pixels that are hit by the triangle. So that's very wasteful. But, so if we have a very small triangle, it becomes very, very wasteful. But yeah, it's rather simple to solve that because we can restrict our iteration to a reasonable region by simply computing the bounding box of the triangle. So the bounding box just means for all vertices, we compute the minimum and the maximum x and y values. And this defines such a box here. And we can extend that, yeah, so that we iterate all the pixels within this box. Yeah, so we remember the simple rasterization examples from last week where we rendered rectangles. Yeah, so that's just a nested for loop that iterates over all possible or all pixels within the bounding box. And for each of these pixels, we make the test with these half spaces, and this allows us to enumerate all the pixels here. Yeah. And because we have that simple rasterization rule that we just look at the pixel center, yeah, we just test for the pixel center whether it's within the triangle or not, and then rasterize it. And if we have a more complex rasterization rule with multiple samples, we check each of these samples using this very simple and efficient test. Okay, yeah, so that's a very simple algorithm. And as I said, simple very often is good. And as I also said, in fact, this is a rasterization that is used on many mobile phones, for instance, because it's very efficient to implement and can also be parallelized very good. Because now all these pixels within this bounding box here can be checked in parallel. They are independent of each other. Yeah. And probably you know that much of the graphics power of GPUs comes from parallelization. So, this is why it's a good algorithm for that. An alternative idea is canline rasterization. That's a little bit more complicated and not used in practice in the form that we show here or that we use here. But nevertheless, it can be also extended to a form that it can become very efficient. But I think it's very good as a mental model also to understand how rasterization works and how also shading works. That means the interpolation of colors, but we will come back to that later. So the idea of scanline rasterization is the following. Yeah, given our triangle, yeah, again here now we already see the rasterization, yeah. Just for every scanline, yeah, scanline now is just a row in our image. Yeah, this is typically called scanline. For every scanline, determine the intersection of that scanline with our polygon. And then fill all the pixels, yeah, that within this intersection. So every scan line, if we have a triangle, yeah, every scan line will intersect our polygon in 2 points, yeah, one point where the scan line enters and one point where it leaves the triangle, and then we simply fill all the pixels in a loop, yeah, from the start to the end point. And then we go to the next scan line, and then we fill all the pixels that are intersected by the next scan line. Yeah? And we do that scan line wise, going from top. Okay. Is it okay?
Yeah.
Good. Okay. Yeah. So the idea is that we go, we sweep over the over our triangle scan line by scan line. For every scan line, we compute the intersections, and then we fill from left to right. Yeah?
So what would happen if the figure is not closed, if it is open diagonal?
Yes, then it doesn't work. So the polygons, we assume that or all the polygons are really always closed shapes. Yeah? So we have P1, P2, P3, P4, P5, and that implicitly means that P5, P1 is also an edge of our shape. Yeah? Otherwise, it doesn't make sense here. Okay, good. So, yeah, this is an illustration how that looks like. And but be aware, yeah, we don't only look at triangles for the moment, but also at more complex shapes, or we explicitly allow arbitrary polygons. So, for instance, also shapes like this. So this can mean that a scan line does not only have one span, but multiple spans. But this is also okay. Yeah, this can happen. If we compute the intersections, we get one here, 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 and here. And then we rasterize always from the first to the second and from the third to the fourth intersection. This somehow assumes that we always have an even number of intersections. But we will also come back to that, that it's rather simple to guarantee that because we have closed shapes. Yeah, that's exactly your question. If we have closed shapes, then we always have two intersections, even in boundary cases, if we define it properly. Okay, good. So how can we do that efficiently? The idea of the algorithm is that, first of all, we take all the edges of our polygons of our polygon that we want to rasterize and do some pre-computation on each of these edges and fill them in a table. And for every edge, we store the following information of our edge. So first of all, we store the starting point. And the starting point, because we proceed over our screen, scan line by scan line, and for now let's assume from top and from bottom to top. Yeah, so we move our scan line upwards. So the first, if we do so, the first vertex that can be hit by a scan line for a particular, or the first point for an edge that can be hit, is the lower point. That's the first point that is seen by sweeping the scan line from bottom to top. So we store this one, the y and the x coordinate. Then we store the upper y coordinate, so from this scan line on, the edge is no longer effective, and we can remove it. And somehow we also have to store the direction of the edge, And we do that by storing the reciprocal of the slope. So delta x over delta y. If this is our edge here, delta x is this, delta y is this, and we store this fraction here, 1 over m. We will see in a minute why. This defines the slope here of our edge, and by knowing the starting point and the slope, we can draw this edge, and by knowing the upper coordinate, we also implicitly know the endpoint. So these are simple transformations that we do in a simple pre-process, so that we transform every edge to such an entry. And all these entries for all edges define our edge table. Okay. And This edge table, now if we take that example, for instance, yeah, we have three edges, so we have three entries in our edge table, and now we go upwards with our scan line. Yeah, so we first determine which scan line is the first that hits our triangle. Yeah, and to do that, we just need to find the first edge or the minimum y value of one of these edges. And then we proceed upwards, yeah, and from time to time we will, for instance, if we are in this scan line, yeah, then this edge will become ineffective, yeah, it's sort of processed and we can throw it away, but this new edge becomes active, yeah. And to find these edges in proper order, what we do is that we simply sort our edge table for the minimum y value. This is also why this stands here right in the front, yeah. We sort all these edges so that the moment when they become active, yeah, is defined by that first entry, and by simply sorting our edge table with respect to this y lower, yeah, we always exactly know in which order we will have to look at them. So in the very beginning, yeah, that means we directly know in which scan line we have to start by looking at the y lower of the first entry in our edge table. And in fact, because we always have two intersections, yeah, there will also be another edge that has the same y lower. And we take these two edges, yeah, and use this y value as our first scan line. And then we transfer these two edges, at least, yeah, maybe even more, to the active edge table. The active edge table now contains all the edges that intersect our current scan line. Yeah, and in this active edge table now, yeah, so here you see an example. So let's say this is our current scan line, so we already proceeded a little bit, yeah, so we are not in the beginning of the algorithm, but already did some rasterization. This is our current, or this is one of the active edges, yeah, and now in the active edge table, what we store is the current intersection with the scan line. So this is this x-intersect. We also store y upper, yeah, because we need that to know when an edge is over, yeah, so that we can remove it and make it inactive by removing it from the edge table. And we also store that 1 over m, because it tells us whenever we proceed to the next scan line, how do we have to update x-intersect. Yeah, so we use that 1 over m for an incremental update. Whenever we use the move the scan line 1 up, we have to add 1 over m to x and immediately get the next x intersect. Yeah, so this is such an incremental update. We did almost the same for the line rasterization. Yeah, you remember the incremental version. Whenever we went 1 to the right, we added m. Yeah, so that we got the new y position, and because now here we don't use x, we swap the role of x and y. This is why we don't use m but 1 over m. Otherwise, the idea is exactly the same. Okay, and now the active edge table, yeah, contains all the intersected edges for our current scan line. As I said, in that example, this will always be true if we have this scan line. It will be this edge in the active edge table, and this will be still in the edge table and waiting to be processed. In this example here, for instance, if we have this scan line, we will have this, and this edge in our active edge table. Yeah. And now if we want to rasterize, we always rasterize from the first to the second and from the third to the fourth, but first and second and so forth means that we also sort the active edge table for their x values. So in the active edge table, we first have this edge, then this, and then this. And it can even happen now if we go from this scan line to this scan line that the relative order of the edges changes. Yeah. So in fact, we even have to look in between whether we have to resort. Yeah. Because in such extreme cases, it can happen that we have to resort. Okay, so this is our active edge table, yeah, and now let's look at an example, yeah. We have this simple polygon here, yeah, in fact a quadrilateral. P1, P2, P3, P4 are the vertices. We have four edges, yeah, and we write all these four edges into a table. I mean, here we describe it with as a linked list, yeah, which is a very inefficient data structure, at least for our purposes, yeah. So in fact, that will be really just a simple table, and the length of that table is just the number of maximal edges that can be processed. Yeah. But nevertheless, it doesn't matter. Yeah. So we have these edges in our edge table. Yeah. So let's maybe find out this edge from P3 to P4. That's the first one. Yeah. It has the starting point Y3, X3. The upper bound y4, that's the y of this point, and this is the 1 over m, the inverse slope. And all these edges are sorted by their first value, so this edge and this edge come first, yeah, it's p3, p4, and p3, p2. They both have the same starting value, so which one is first is arbitrary for now, yeah. They will be sorted for X only in the active edge table. Then comes this edge here, P4, P1, and then P2, P1. It looks like here Y2 and Y4 would be the same. I'm not really sure. So here Y4 is at least not larger than Y2, because then it would have to be later. Okay. So that's a kind of pre-process that we have to do. Yeah, it's very simple. It's just writing the values in a different manner, so that now in the iteration, when we want to do our algorithm, we have all the data available quickly that we need. Okay, and now during the iteration, yeah, when we sweep the scan line from bottom to top. Yeah, we always have in the active edge table the two or four or six intersected edges. So in that case, if Yscan is here, yeah, our active edge table will contain the edges P3, P2, and P3, P4. These are the corresponding values, and now for X, we only have the intersection with the current scan line, so that's X prime and X2 prime, yeah. So the starting X is not of interest anymore. Yeah, we don't need it in the active edge table. We need to know Y2 because we need to know when we proceed with Yscan, when to stop, and we need Y4. And we need this to update X prime and X2 prime if we go one up. Yeah. But this is how the active edge table looks for Yscan. And now we simply rasterize from X prime to X2 prime. Yeah, very simple. Yeah, we now know all pixels from here to here can be filled. Of course, we need some rounding, yeah, so that we have this rule with the center of the pixel. But this is a little bit painful, but doable. Yeah, so if our active edge table looks like this, this means rasterize from X prime to X prime prime. Okay, now the only remaining question essentially is, yeah, how do we update now? Yeah, so if we proceed the scan line now from here to here, how do we update? And as I said, that's very simple. We can simply update X prime by adding this value, and this one we can update by adding this value. So when we go up with a scan line by one, we can simply update by adding 1 over m, this X value. And this value, we now have to check whether when we proceed with a scan line, whether our edge is still active. If this is not the case, we simply remove it from the active edge table. And automatically, usually that means if one edge becomes inactive, that another one becomes active. Yeah, so we also take from the edge table
those remaining edges that are now hit by that new scan line. Yeah, so we always take edges from the edge table, move it to the active edge table, and when they become inactive, they are thrown away. And in the end, edge table and active edge table are empty and we are done. Yeah, and the update rules are very simple. Yeah, so we simply proceed the scan line and we update X by, that's exactly the argument that we also made for lines, when we proceed along X and update Y. But here we proceed along Y and update X. So that's why we use 1 over M and not N. And this, in the end, is the final algorithm. So we initialize the edge table and the active edge table. In the beginning, the active edge table is empty. And then we set Y scan to the Y lower of the first entry in the edge table. The first entry in the edge table gives us the lowest edge, or probably the lowest two edges. Yeah, this is where we have to start our algorithm. Yeah, and then we move all edges from the active edge table that start in the scan line, usually 2, maybe also 4, if we have whatever, something like this. Yeah, and the first scan line hits this, and this edge. Yeah, then we have 4, and you can also construct more examples with 6 or so, but normally it will be 2. We move them to the active edge table, and at the same time remove it from the edge table. Yeah, so the edge table becomes smaller and smaller. Okay, and now, while neither the edge table nor the active edge table are empty, as long as we still have active edges, we sort the active edge table for X. Yeah, that's because we always want to render rasterize from the first to the second and from the third to the fourth and so on. Yeah, so this is rather simple because normally it will be sorted. And we can immediately see that, and otherwise bubble sort is just fine. Yeah, and it's not a long list. Yeah, so usually one iteration of bubble sort and we are done. Okay, and then we draw lines from the zeroth entry to the first and from the second to the third and so forth. Yeah, so this is the real rasterization part now. Yeah, here the pixels are set. And it's always within a scan line, neighboring pixels. Yeah, so it's a very simple loop to iterate over these pixels here. Now this is this is the goal. Yeah, here the work is done that we want to do. Then we remove all edges from our active edge table for which this was the last scan line. Yeah, so if the current scan with the current scan line we reach the end of the of our edge, we remove it from the active edge table. For the remaining edges in the active edge table, we update X. Then we go to the next scan line and we move all edges from the edge table, which become now active, to the active edge table. Yeah, and normally the normal case is that if an edge disappears from the active edge table, in the next step, a new edge from the edge table is pulled to our active table. Yeah, and that's it. Yeah, and we do that until all edges have been processed, and that automatically all these tables are empty if our scan line reaches the top of the polygon, and then we are done. Yeah, and you see, now all these steps are rather simple. I mean, it's a little bit so the sorting is not very nice, and the moving of data between edge table and active edge table, is maybe not very elegant, but this can all be optimized. This is a kind of, as I said, mental model how that might work. But of course, it would be possible to do that differently and more efficiently and keep these tables implicitly and so forth. Okay, but that's not so important for now. So let's look at how this algorithm works for a practical example. Yeah, let's say this is our polygon. Yeah, it's not a very simple case because you see there are scan lines where we have multiple active edges, obviously. So it's not convex. It has at least 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 edges.
And this is how our edge table looks like in the beginning. Yeah, so all coordinates here are integers, so that we can write down that easily, but that's not necessarily the case. Yeah, so all coordinates can be arbitrary float values. Okay, and now, interesting for the start, are edges E1 and E2. They all have 1, y equals 1, as y lower value here. Yeah, and then comes this edge, E4, in scan line 4. In scan line 3 comes that one. And I already see that should be sorted for y lower. So, in fact, okay, yeah, so this is the first step, yeah, that this table is sorted, and here we now have the sorted edge table. Okay? So this is the order in which we have to look at the edges, and in the very beginning, we look at the first two. They both have y lower of 1. That means we have to start in scan line 1 and pull these two edges to the active edge table, yeah? Now, the first two are moved to the active edge table. The other three remain in the edge table. We will look at them later in later scan lines. But for now, only these two edges are interesting. We initialize the x value by the x value here, yeah, because in the beginning, we intersect exactly at the starting point. So yeah, these are the x values. Y upper. Yeah, this first edge is active until scan line 3, and this one is active until scan line 7. 1 over m helps us to increment, so this is 3. Whenever we walk one scan line up, we go 3 to the right for edge 1, and we go 1/2 to the right for edge 2. Yeah. Okay, and then we can immediately rasterize scan line 1. By rasterizing pixels from 1 to 1. Yeah, and this gives us the first pixel here. And then we go to the next scan line. Yeah, we update. And what we mainly have to update is x. And simply by adding the 3 and the 1/2 here, so this one becomes 4 and this becomes 1.5. And because we have to sort now, yeah, so here it was still not clear which one is the leftmost. But now after that, yeah, it is clear this is the left one. So we also sort, and now we have the new x position 1.5 and 3. Yeah? And now we can rasterize again from 1.5 to 3. We update again. Now we are, this x is 2. Yeah, 1.5 plus 1/2 becomes 2, 3. 4 plus 3 becomes 7. This minus is wrong here, by the way. Okay, and no, it's not wrong, sorry. Or is it wrong? Is it already the new edge? Yeah, because now we already reached the here with this scan line. We reached the end of edge 1, so edge 1 is removed from the active edge table, but we also reached the start of E4. So E4 is moved from the edge to the active edge table, yeah? And you see it has a new 1 over m, so this 1 minus, this minus 3 is probably correct. And now we can continue. We rasterize from here to here and update again. And now in the next scan line, E2 and E4 remain active, but also E3 and E5 become active. Yeah, so we are now in scan. If we are in scan line 4, both of these are moved to the active edge table. Yeah, and now we have an active edge table with 4 entries. We fill from the first to the second, or from the 0th to the first, and from the second to the third, and so forth. Yeah, and you can proceed until we are at the end. Yeah.
I have a question. Would you mind going back to the
Oh, that can be.
because in the two last lines, yeah. It says it increments y scan before it moves all the edges from the edge table to the active edge table, but that would mean we would skip over the intersection point, wouldn't we? So we remove, when we reach the end of one edge, we remove that edge, then increment Y scan, and then move all the edges.
Yeah, okay. So, but then the error is probably more in this part, right? That we first should. Yeah. Okay, that could be. Yeah. Okay, I cannot. Yeah. So. Yeah. That's possible. Yeah. So that first we should. Probably we should first increment Y scan and then look at. How that works. I mean, this, as I said, this assumes that we have integer coordinates anyhow. Yeah. So if we have floating point coordinates, we have to look at that a little bit more closely and don't use equal, but instead less than or smaller or equal. Yeah. To do that correctly. Yeah. But it can be. Yeah. It's absolutely possible. Okay. Good. But I think the general principle, I hope that the general principle becomes clear. Yeah, and the implementation, as I also said, I mean, in practice, one wouldn't do it with linked lists and stuff like that. Yeah, that's and maybe even allocate new objects with new or delete or stuff like that. Yeah, that's all too costly. But normally, yeah, really highly optimized versions of these algorithms are used in the end. Yeah, so this is just the general principle of how to do that. And in particular, if we look, for instance, at a triangle, yeah, you might realize that the edge table for a triangle, obviously, it always only has three entries. Yeah, and it's not the number of possible situations is rather small. Yeah, in fact, you only have two faces, one where the first two edges are active and then where the first and the third edge are active. Yeah, and you can simply pre-sort your edge table, yeah, so that they all appear in the right order, and you can immediately do all that stuff within a simple table. Yeah, so please don't say that you learned in my computer graphics lecture that a GPU works with directly this implementation. Yeah, so this is not the code as it is implemented on a GPU. Definitely not. Okay, but the principle, yeah, that's important. And now you might say, okay, next week, yeah, I will show you how you can use, for instance, OpenGL, yeah, to do rasterization. So you have a library, you have dedicated hardware that does this very efficiently. Yeah, so why should I care? One thing is that I think it's also important to understand how shading works. And this is what we will look into now for the rest of the lecture. How do we, for now, I always only said, okay, we just set the pixels inside a triangle. But normally we do not only have black and white images, but we have color. Yeah? And we don't want our triangles that we rasterize normally to have a uniform color, but latest, if we look at 3D objects, we want to have a shading on these objects. Yeah, so we want to have a color gradient, a smooth transition between colors, so that objects look smooth. And now the interesting question is, yeah, how could we add this to our rasterization pipeline? Yeah, how can we get color gradients? And yeah, if you look at that in 2D libraries, like SVG, for instance, you will find that we can define certain fill colors for objects. Not only fill colors, but more complicated things like color gradients. You can define at this position, it should be white, and then there should be a gradient to red and to blue, for instance. Yeah, so we define a direction, or a direction is defined.
And then you can say along this direction, which colors appear. So start with yellow, and then here at this position is green, and then here it's blue, and it should end in white. Yeah? And so such things result from that. Yeah? So we can have a linear gradient in x and y direction, and in fact in arbitrary directions. Or there are special stuff like radial gradients. Yeah? So you define a point, and at this point it should be red, and the further you go away from red, at some point it should turn blue, and so forth. Yeah. And by this you can add such shading. But this is not what we will want. Yeah. What we will want in the end, and we will see that if we come to 3D objects, is the following idea, that if we rasterize such a triangle or an arbitrary polygon, we want to define colors at the vertices of that triangle, and then interpolate the color over the triangle. And in fact, later on, we will not only interpolate colors, but several different attributes over a triangle. Yeah? So we will always have that problem that we have attributes given at the vertices, like for instance color, and then during rasterization want to interpolate them. Yeah, and so that if we have an arbitrary pixel here, yeah, we can quickly determine which color should that have, and that color is just a mix of red, blue, and green, and the closer we are to a vertex, the more important this attribute somehow, yeah, is for that particular pixel. Okay. And yeah, that's a core problem, how to do interpolation. A very big part of computer graphics is reasonable interpolation, yeah, because it's mostly the best you can do. And how is that done? Yeah, you should have learned stuff, related stuff already in AlgoKS, for instance. Yeah, for those of you who attended this lecture, probably not everybody did. The core for doing simple interpolation, it's not always a good interpolation, but the most practical way very often is to use so-called barycentric coordinates. And the ideas of barycentric coordinates is very simple. So let's assume we have a triangle. So barycentric coordinates usually are only defined for triangles. There are extensions also for arbitrary polygons. For now, we only look at triangles. So let's say we have a triangle ABC with vertices A, B, and C, and we have an arbitrary point P inside that triangle. And then it can be shown that every point P here inside that triangle can be described by what we call an affine combination of the vertices. So that means P is such an affine combination, and that means vertices A, B, and C weighted with coefficients alpha, beta, and gamma. Alpha, beta, and gamma are scalar values. And alpha and beta and gamma must sum up to 1. Yeah? And in fact, we can describe every point on the plane as such a linear combination, but points inside the triangle have also the property that alpha, beta, and gamma are all in the range between 0 and 1. Yeah? And so maybe to illustrate that briefly, we can look at the following example. Let's say we have vertices A, B, and C. Many probably would have said, okay, the typical way we could describe now a point within that triangle is maybe that we take this as basis for a coordinate system. Yeah, we say A is our origin, and then we make something like A plus U times this vector, which is B minus A, plus V times C minus A. Yeah, so every point, these are, yeah, now we describe a point with respect to that new coordinate system. Yeah? So if we say now u and v should be between 0 and 1, we get all these points. Yeah, we get such a parallelogram that is spawned by these two vectors. Yeah, and Now it's rather simple to show that all points on these within this triangle also require that u plus v is smaller than 1. Yeah, this then skips all that part, and then only this triangle is left. And in fact, this is exactly the same, because what we can do now, yeah, is that we multiply this out, then we get a plus u times b minus u times a plus v times c minus v times a. And now if we sort for a, b, and c, yeah, we get 1 minus u times a plus u times b plus, and for c we have v. V times c, and here I also need, 1 minus u minus v times a plus u times b plus v times c. Yeah, that's now just rearranged, and now you immediately see the barycentric coordinates. Yeah, this is beta, this is gamma, and this here is alpha, and because it's 1 minus u minus v, yeah, alpha plus beta plus gamma is 1. 1 minus u minus v plus u plus v is 1. Yeah? So it's exactly the same idea, just written in a different manner, more symmetric. Okay, good. Just a little side remark. Okay, so every point within our triangle can be described using these barycentric coordinates, a, b, and c. Yeah, it's a little bit unintuitive that we have three coordinates to address points on a 2D triangle, yeah, but the reason is that here we have this requirement on this sum. Okay, and how does that help us? I mean, if we now have an arbitrary point, P, yeah, and we want to interpolate its color, so let's say A has some color, B has some color, and C has some color, we can use exactly the same weights to interpolate these colors, yeah? Because obviously, if a point is very close to A, then the alpha value will be rather large and beta and gamma will be small, yeah? And vice versa. And in fact, I forgot to mention that here, these barycentric coordinates can also be interpreted looking at these triangle areas here. So the barycentric coordinate with respect to A, for instance, alpha, is the area of this triangle, of the opposite triangle. And now you can see the closer we move the point to A, the larger this triangle will become. And in the end, if we are on A, then alpha will be 1. It's the barycentric coordinates are the relative area of that triangle with respect to the entire triangle. Yeah, so if this point moves to A, alpha will be 1, beta and gamma will be 0. So alpha tells us how close, in some sense, are we to A. Gamma tells us how close are we to C, and beta how close are we to B. And we can immediately use these weights to also interpolate other attributes. Yeah? In this case, colors, for instance, but it will also work for other attributes. Okay, and this is a linear interpolation. Why so? If we take this triangle, yeah, and put it here on a table, and we take the attribute values, and we do this interpolation, then the interpolated values will all be on a plane. Yeah, the interpolation, if we look at these interpolated attributes as a height field, they will all be on a plane. So that's a linear interpolation. Okay, and it's very simple. But it also has problems. But it's a very practical thing. Okay, and now how can we integrate that into our scanline algorithm? Yeah, I promised you that seeing or having an idea how scanline algorithms work also helps to understand how shading works. The idea is that when we do our rasterization and we do our scanline algorithm, we can integrate these interpolations directly. And what we can do is that So let's assume we have this single attribute color stored with our vertices. Yeah. So what we can do now in our edge table is that we also do the interpolation of these attributes as part of our scanline algorithm. That means for every edge, we store the starting value of the color along this edge. And when we now proceed, yeah, we always keep the current color value along this edge when intersected with the scan line, like the x value, yeah, that we interpolate when we move upwards. We also always keep the current color along this edge, yeah, so that we do not only know the x value of the starting point, but also the color of the starting point. And we also know the color of the endpoint of this second edge in our active edge table. Yeah, so our active edge table becomes a little bit larger. And when we now do the rasterization, we say, okay, we interpolate along our scan line from this color to this color. So that means, yeah, we have to compute and or interpolate these colors linearly along here, and that can also be efficiently done. Yeah, and so what we achieve with this. Now, this is maybe a little bit dangerous because some of you might say, okay, this is a linear interpolation along this edge and a linear interpolation along this edge. And then we interpolate in this direction. So isn't that bilinear? No, it's not. It's still linear. Bilinear would be that we have a square and we interpolate, we have here values. And we interpolate along these. So yeah, to get the color at some point. We interpolate along these two edges. This gives this value along these two edges. And then in this direction to get this value. This is bilinear. And the difference is that it has four vertices. Yeah, this has three vertices. And even if it's a sort of linear interpolation in this direction and then in this direction, it's not bilinear, but still linear. A bilinear surface, by the way, is not, is curved. It can be curved. Yeah. And this one is really a plane if we render it as a height field. Okay. Good. Yeah. So, this allows us to integrate it. And in fact, in the scanline algorithm, and in fact, all these incremental ideas that we use in the scanline algorithm, we can also apply here. That means if we do this interpolation along the edges, we do not always recompute the new interpolated value here, but instead we store increments. That means we start here with our start color, and then we compute whenever we go one scan line up, how much does the color change, yeah? And it's always the same along this entire line. Yeah, so we store, do not only store this 1 over m to update x, but also we store an increment to update our color along this scan line. Yeah, and so now things become very, very simple. Yeah, in our active edge table, for every attribute, we have its current value and the increment, and when we go to the next scan line, we simply add the increment to the current value. Yeah, and then we know the start and the end color. And when we proceed over the span, we can also compute the increment if going one pixel to the right. And then we start here with a start color. And we simply always update our color by adding that increment. And that gives us this these color values here along the scan line. Okay. So that's simple. It integrates nicely. It cannot only be used to interpolate color. In fact, I mean, color, as you know, is not a single value. It's an RGB value. So we have to do that anyhow for red, green, and blue independently. But there are also many other attributes that we, or several other attributes that we will see in the rest of the lecture. Like, for instance, the surface normal can be interpolated like that, texture coordinates, and stuff like that. Yeah. Okay, but for color, it's probably easiest to understand and easiest to see. Okay, good. So one thing is still to be considered. So for now, or in the beginning with the barycentric coordinates, I told you that they only work for triangles. But if we look at that algorithm here, yeah, and if I say it's easy to integrate into scanline, you might say, okay, scanline does not only work for triangles. Yeah? So doesn't also this interpolation work for arbitrary polygons? And in fact, yes, it does. So we can use this scheme here to also do an interpolation on arbitrary polygons. It also gives results that look reasonable in the beginning, but there is one interesting problem that also shows the limits. Yeah? And this is the following. Let's look at this example here. We have a quadrilateral A, B, C, D. For each of these for each of these vertices, we have a color. Yeah? And now we look at this scan line. And obviously, in that setup, the color of this point, where does it come from? Yeah, first of all, along this edge, the color of D and A is interpolated. Along this edge, the color of B and A is interpolated. Yeah, and the resulting color again is interpolated. So the color of this point depends on the color of A, B, and D. Yeah, it's a linear interpolation within that triangle ABD. But the color of C, it's independent of the color of C. Yeah, the color of C doesn't go into the color here. But now if we rotate our quad, yeah, to this position, we just rotated 90 degrees to the right. Now it looks like this. Yeah? And now we take the very same point. Yeah? It's exactly the same point within our polygon, but now it's here. And if we now do the same consideration, we see now the color depends on A, C, and D, but no longer on B. Yeah? So obviously, just by rotating the object, yeah, the color of this point changes. Yeah? So if I have now my quadrilateral, yeah, and I rotate it, the colors within that quadrilateral will change, which is not good. Yeah, so this becomes visible, and in fact, yeah, you will see, and it depends even whether do a scan line, or I mean, alternatively, we could also do a scan row algorithm. Yeah. And then the scan row algorithm would deliver a different result from a scan line. Yeah, so the interpolation depends on the algorithm to rasterize, which is not good. Yeah, for triangles, this is no problem. You can take an arbitrary triangle and rotate the triangle, and the color distribution or the interpolation within the triangle will never change. Yeah, it's consistent, but for polygons, it is not. Yeah, and this is also the reason why, or one of the reasons probably why usually not polygons are used for rasterization, but triangles. Yeah, because if we subdivide, I mean, in fact, here it could be somehow interpreted like or as follows. In that case, yeah, we subdivided our only for interpolation. We subdivided our quadrilateral along this edge, yeah, and do an interpolation within this triangle and this triangle. Yeah. So if this is A, and in that case, yeah, now A is here, we also subdivided in this direction, but if we transfer it to here, it would be a subdivision in this direction. So we have two different triangulations for the same quadrilateral, and both triangulations result, yeah, in a different interpolation. Yeah. And if we rotate, yeah, it sort of flips in between, which is very unelegant. And if we take arbitrary polygons and always first triangulate them, then everything is fixated. Yeah, then we can rotate as we wish. Things won't change anymore. Okay, yeah, so that's a rather advanced part of rasterization, but maybe worth being discussed, or maybe if you read it for the second or third time, you will see what I mean here. Then there's another subtle thing that you should also be aware of, or that's also worth thinking about if we speak about shading. And these are so-called hanging vertices or inconsistencies, vertex inconsistencies. And here you can see an example. What we have here are three polygons, three quadrilaterals, and these quadrilaterals together form a larger polygon. Yeah, so it's a larger or a square subdivided into three rectangles like this. Yeah, and for some reason, maybe you also want to have a new color here so that we get a nice shading on this object here. Okay, now we have a very simple problem. Even if we define color for all these vertices, the color at C, if we look at the left polygon, the color at C is just the average value of the color of A and B, yeah? Because here polygon 1 doesn't know vertex C. Okay, this is what we assume. So C, the polygon here, has this vertex, this vertex, this vertex, and this vertex, but not C, yeah, because it's here on the edge anyhow. Yeah, so we didn't use C. It would just make the polygon larger, and it's not necessary, yeah, because it doesn't contribute. The polygon with C or without C is exactly the same. So we remove C, and as a result, during interpolation of this here, at C, we get the color that is just between A and B, the average of A and B. But for these two, C is an important vertex, so it is used, and so we can get another color here. So we don't get a smooth color gradient, yeah, or a smooth shading, but we will always see this edge here. Yeah? And this is one instance of a more general problem. So we should always avoid such cases here. In that case, we should add C to the polygon on the left, to avoid such problems. Yeah? And this is what we call hanging nodes. And hanging nodes are always known to make problems because they always result in problems when doing interpolation. Okay, these are very, as I said, very specialized things. You will see them maybe in practice at some points and then maybe remember, there was this thing. Now I understand what a hanging node is. and they can also result in other problems, like, for instance, generate holes during rasterization. Yeah, because if you rasterize these and these, due to rounding errors, it can now always happen that there are maybe tiny or single pixels missing here along these edges. And if we don't have hanging nodes, rasterization can be defined in a way that such holes are always avoided. But in that case, this won't work anymore. Okay, good. As I said, very specialized. The important parts are the algorithms before and the shading. And as I also said, in practice, we won't really use these algorithms or implement these algorithms because normally they are provided in a very efficient implementation by some libraries or also even in hardware, and this is what we will look into next week. We will now see how we can program a GPU, a special graphics processor, to do exactly this rasterization task. And this will help us to rasterize easily millions or maybe even billions of triangles per second. And this cannot be simply done. This requires special library calls and special functionality, and we have to consider the architectures of these GPUs. And this is what we will look into next week. Thank you.